You would think that the victims of war would be the last ones to get into the business of inventing new weapons. An Duong was a teenage girl in Saigon when she fled from the invasion of communist forces. She stuffed everything she owned into a little duffel bag and, along with her family, eventually made her way to the U.S. Partly out of gratitude to the American forces, and partly with her own personal version of never again, she's now a weapons designer in Washington.
Coming from a background of mine, who was a refugee of war, who saw my country destroyed because South Vietnam did not have the means to win. It's not because South Vietnamese didn't want to stay free, but we weren't allowed that. Why? Because we didn't have sophisticated weapons. We didn't have the means.
An Duong says the U.S. military should have the best weapons in the world. There's no doubt in her mind that's the best way to end a war, not prolong it. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
The Times of London is reporting today that the U.S. is making plans to send a further 7,000 troops into Afghanistan. It's apparently in response to a resurgence of the Taliban and al-Qaeda forces in that country, and it follows this year's annual report on terrorism by the U.S. State Department.
Al-Qaeda remains the biggest terrorist threat to the United States, according to the U.S. State Department's annual report on terrorism. In the two theaters of U.S.-led wars, terrorism incidents in Iraq dropped last year, but they rose in Afghanistan.
New U.S. troops in Afghanistan would bring the American forces there up to about 40,000. Now, the last time the U.S. had so many people in Afghanistan, the hunt was on for Osama bin Laden. And that's what brings us to today's story. One of the key designers of the bombs that had been designed to attack al-Qaeda mountain strongholds is a woman from Vietnam. An Duong works as a science advisor to the U.S. Navy, and she says her aim is always peace, not war.
I think of families of soldiers who are waiting for their loved ones coming back from the war. And as you know, when one goes into war, the only way to come back intact is to win.
An Duong still wonders what might have happened at her home in Vietnam if the South Vietnamese forces and the Americans had been able to win. Her story begins with an image of her, one that she remembers well. She was a young girl, 8 years old, and her older brother was a pilot fighting alongside the Americans.
The memory that I would carry with me for the rest of my life is the memory of standing by the gate waiting for the return of my brother. He was a helicopter pilot in the South Vietnamese Air Force. So there were many occasions where I would stand by that gate, tears streaming down my face, waving goodbye to him, thinking that this might be the very last time that I would ever see him alive. As a girl, I still remember my wishful thinking at that point. I wish I were a fairy with this wand that I could just wave and come up with these sophisticated weapons for my brother to use so that he could win and come back alive.
I can see you at the gate waving farewell to him, but you would never know when he was coming back. Would you just stand there and wait?
Yes, stand and wait. Of course, an 8-year-old kid, you know, I didn't know much. But from time to time, I would just wish that he was back, and I would just stand at the gate looking out, you know, waiting, wondering whether I would see him turning the corner.
Did you think by waiting there that you might bring him back?
As a kid, you had those thoughts. Maybe if I kept looking, you know, he would turn up. But then as I grew older, of course, I knew that wasn't the case.
Years later, on a day when An's brother came home on a break, he told the family that the war wasn't going to last much longer and that he had a plan to get them out on his helicopter.
His friend has a house near the outskirts of Saigon, and in the back of the house is a big field, open field. So, of course, you know, for a helicopter to land, you have to find a spot. Mm-hmm. So he told my parents that when things got really desperate, seemed like it's hopeless, maybe the family should gather there just in case. And, of course, there's no counting on whether we would be able to contact him or vice versa.
Yeah.
So he just told my parents, you know, go to that house, wait there, and if possible, he would try to come back and get us on the helicopter. Everybody wanted to get out. Nobody that I knew at that time was welcoming the fact that the communists was coming in. Everybody wanted to leave. Everybody wanted to go as far away as they could from the communists. As human beings, it takes us a while to accept that disaster is here.
Yeah.
And we're about to lose our country. It's a very hard fact to accept, even for a kid like me. So I remember my parents debating day in and day out whether we should go. Is this the right time? Is this, you know, really desperate yet? We still hung on to every piece of optimistic. You know, you read the paper, and of course there were a lot of editorial columns, and you hung on to those optimistic opinion that some writer might point out this or that, oh no, that's a sign that, you know, we'll be okay. That's what my parents did more. I was mainly concerned about, will I have the chance to say goodbye to my teachers, to my friends? What about my pets, my beloved cats and dogs? You know, as a kid, that's what I worried about. I was too young to worry about what will happen to us, where would we live, are we going to get out alive, things like that. That was more what the adults worried about, or who gets to go, you know, what if the helicopter never showed up, mm-hmm. or say the helicopter did show up, but what if there's not enough space? Because, of course, it wasn't just our family. It's also my uncle was there with his family, my brother's friend, you know, the owner of the house, of course, his family there. So there were overall about 50 people. One discussion was about, all right, then who we know for sure would be in danger if they stay behind, the young male in the family. They would be drafted to go into a communist army. The decision was made that older people would stay and the younger people would be the ones that would go because, of course, my parents, like my uncles and everybody, think about the future. So it's the younger generation that would get the chance for freedom and the older generation would stay behind.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. An Duong's family never did have to split up, but she only knew this on the day when the family got word it was time to get to that open field.
It was very sudden, at least as far as I know, that afternoon when my mom said to me, we're going to leave in a couple of hours. Get your stuff together. And I remember crying while I packed this little bag, and I was told I could only have this one duffel bag. So I stuffed it with mainly pictures, my teacher, my childhood friends, and a few pieces of my best clothes. You know, hey, I was a girl, okay? So I was vain, I had to admit. So, yeah, I packed best clothes, best shoes.
What was it like waiting for the helicopter?
I didn't sleep that night, but I just cried the whole time thinking about my pets, who's going to feed them, and what will happen to them. Then the next day, I heard this loud noise. I didn't realize what it was. It just so loud. And then my mother shook me and said, hurry, hurry, get up. The helicopter's here. So I ran, and she said, hurry up. We have to leave immediately, you know, get on the helicopter, get on. I said, what about my bag and things? And she said, don't worry, just go on, go on. When I ran out of the house, I saw two helicopters. So we were able to get everybody on with all the belongings.
Yeah, did
we
you
left
get
Saigon.
Your bag?
Yes, my mom did. We got to the open sea, and then my brother shouted to my mom. He said that we had to be prepared to throw some of our, well, maybe all of our belongings out because it seems that the helicopter was overloaded. And with the open sea and the strong wind, he had problem, you know, maintaining altitude is what I understood afterwards. But all I heard from him was, be prepared, we're going to have to throw our bags out. And that's when I started crying again. And I remember clutching that little bag to my chest, refusing to let go because, of course, that was all I got left. And I would not let go of those pictures. And I cried the whole time, said no. But in the end, I was able to keep my little bag. I guess even in the darkest moment of our life, I still got special treatment because I'm the only girl and the youngest in my family. I guess my mom just didn't have the heart.
But a lot of people did have to throw their belongings in the ocean, did they?
Yes.
The helicopters eventually landed on a ship. But the adventure wasn't over. The Duong family refugees soon found they'd have to transfer to another, much larger ship, and they'd have to do it by jumping.
Because of the waves, you have to wait for the right moment when the waves bring the boat closest to the ship.
So you're going just one at a time at this point?
Yes, one at a time. Somebody would shout, jump, you know, and that's when you have to make the jump immediately. Yeah. I was standing in line, and my cousin was right in front of me, and he made the jump at the wrong moment. I saw him not reaching the other side, and I still have the picture in my mind of him sliding down the side of the other ship.
Into the water?
Yeah, and I closed my eyes thinking that he was going to die. When I opened my eyes again, a miracle must have happened because he was able to hang on to something. And I remember his feet were inches away from being smashed. And then somebody shouted in my ears that I was next.
And I bet your confidence is way up at this point.
But, you know, it's funny. I remember I was very calm. I walk up to the spot. I calmly looked and calculated, you know, the distance and the thought that went through my mind at that point, thinking I wasn't going to make it. I figured even if I stretched, I wasn't going to be able. But, you know, when somebody said jump, I did. And I remember trying to stretch, trying to do my best to reach the other side. And of course, on the other side, there are a lot of people reaching out, trying to grab, you know. And I remember being grabbed by somebody and being pulled up. I remember that sensation also. And I remember making to that ship and walk around, you know, like nothing happened. And then I remember looking for my family. And when I saw my dad, I broke down and cried. And then I remember the cold sweat. And that's when I started to feel so scared and so helpless.
An Duong eventually made it to the U.S., and she overcame that feeling of helplessness. She made her way through this country's school system all the way to the place she occupies now as a leading weapons designer for the U.S. Navy. I'll talk more with her about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. And this time last week, we heard news about the U.S. dropping a series of bombs on the home of an al-Qaeda leader in Somalia. Well, if present trends continue, we'll likely be hearing more about the use of such high-tech weapons as the hunt for al-Qaeda is stepped up, once again, in Afghanistan. Today, I'm talking with one of the most senior designers of this U.S. weaponry. What makes An Duong's story so interesting is that she was once the victim of aerial bombardment herself. When she was a schoolgirl in Saigon, she lived with the fear that the Viet Cong rockets might hit her home.
It usually happened at night, just randomly, you know, killing civilians. A friend of my dad, his entire home was decimated in one of those. Luckily, his entire family was away that night, so none of them died. But, you know, his family home was entirely destroyed. And I remember lying sleeplessly some of those nights, listening to the sound and thinking, when will it be our turn? But even then, as a teenager or a young girl, I kept wondering, why would they do that? In a war, yeah, we understand the only way to come back alive is to defeat the enemy. But why would you randomly kill civilians by dropping mortars into a city? And I thought, gee, is that really a way to win the heart of the people? Even, you know, at a young age, I wonder about those things.
An Duong's family escaped from Saigon in 1975. They went through a series of refugee camps and eventually settled in Washington, D.C. An did surprisingly well on her English tests.
They put me in regular English, rather than the special class for people who don't speak English as a native language.
And how was your English at that time, An?
I had about 50 words. And even my best friend, who was an American, kept joking that you must have bribed Mrs. Wapnick. How could you get into this class?
How did you end up with a career in science if you were doing so well in English?
When I was in Vietnam, my dream was to become a writer. So when I got to high school here, my father sat me down and said, you know, that dream of yours is no longer practical. I assume that you know that by now, right, dear? You're going to have to go into math and science. No choice. because math and science is a universal language. I resented that at first because I thought, you know, it was going to kill my creativity, etc., etc. But to my pleasant surprise, I have to admit, you know, one could be creative in any field.
What age were you when you decided that you wanted to head towards a career with defense, a career where you'd be designing, making weapons?
Of course, I went into college knowing that I would have to study in engineering. But then as I go through college, more and more I understood about American society, more and more I understood what one could do as an engineer. That's when the determination could solidify, because I was determined to pay back. I'm talking about the 58,000 Americans whose names are on the wall of the Vietnam War Memorial, the 260,000 South Vietnamese soldiers who gave their lives in that war, the numerous war veterans and wounded soldiers, and the generous and compassionate American people who helped me. So I know that I wanted to go into public service. That is a given. Because of my strong compassion for the soldiers, I wanted to work for defense because I want to help them so that they could come home alive. Because I think of me as that little girl waiting by the gate, wishing my brother would stay alive and come back to me. So I think of families of soldiers who are waiting for their loved ones coming back from the war. And as you know, when one goes into war, the only way to come back intact is to win. I want to help the soldiers who continue to keep me and you and my family safe and free. I want to help them.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. An Duong is now a senior science advisor for the Navy, working on precisely the kinds of weapons that are most useful to the U.S. in its current campaign against terrorist groups. Her particular contribution is called the thermobaric bomb. It's one that can infiltrate caves and other hard-to-reach places. She first got the idea for this new kind of bomb back in the 90s when warfare began to change.
As American weapons get more and more sophisticated, more and more accurate, basically, we could defeat any what we call line-of-sight targets. So if I were the enemy, what would I do? I would hide, right? I would go into tunnels, caves, deeply buried structures. And at that time, I was in charge of all the Navy explosive research and development. So I knew that in order to develop such a weapon, we had to develop a different kind of explosive that would deliver energy slowly and last longer so that the blast or the effect could penetrate those hard-to-reach targets. But I couldn't convince anybody of such idea. So as the one in charge of explosive R&D, I was able to fund a lot of basic science and technology that would work toward the development of such explosive, but I could never scale up the explosive or go into weapon development. And that went on for 4 or 5 years or longer. But then in the summer of 2001, I finally convinced Department of Defense, Office of Secretary of Defense, and I was approved for a 3-year program to demonstrate a new, what they call tunnel defeat weapon. And the crux of that is to come up with an explosive for that new warhead or that new weapon. And then September 11 happened. So I got a call exactly a month after 9/11. Hey, Jan, guess what? OSD, Office of Secretary of Defense, just called. They're now asking us to postpone the 3-year plan. Instead, I am to take my best guess and create that weapon immediately because the decision is to send our troops into Afghanistan. And we know that the Taliban hide in those mountainous tunnels and caves. And without this kind of weapon, our guys would have to flush out those caves or tunnels themselves.
How easy was it going to be for you to go from a 3-year design and development schedule to right away?
You take a lot of risk. Instead of having a program plan where you have dozens of successive steps, I now have to carry them out as parallel steps. Normally, I would have to wait for the result of step A before I know what to do in step B. Now, I would have to assume what the results would be.
How long was it before you had one of these thermobaric bombs ready for field use?
From the time that we got the call to the time that we fielded 11 of these bombs, total of 67 days. And I must point out that I didn't do it alone.
I was going to say, though, did you ever get home during that time?
Seldom, but yes. The thing is, when you work in explosives, you cannot be tired because that's when you make mistake. And if you make mistake, you're not only going to kill yourself, but a lot of your co-workers. And knowing that our guys, our troops, are in Afghanistan, without this weapon, any day that would delay is a day that they would have to go into those caves themselves. I had a team of over 100 scientists, engineers, technicians, clerks, and they all were motivated beyond belief, especially with the image of our 9/11 victims still fresh in our mind, what happened in New York City, what happened in Pentagon, where some of my colleagues were in there. Failure was just not an option.
I have in my hand on a newspaper description of what the thermobaric bomb can do, and I'm going to read it and ask you if it's accurate. It says, the thermobaric bomb is designed to tunnel through convoluted caves and pulverize anyone hiding as deep as 1,100 feet inside, then incinerate whatever remains, that it can crush caves with a super hot blast that can destroy internal organs as far as a quarter mile away. Is that accurate?
No. I think somebody, whoever wrote that, I guess they pulled things off from the internet. I don't know.
Okay, so you tell me, what can this bomb do that makes it so distinctive?
It is a bomb that delivers traveling blasts. Normal bomb, when you drop it at the cave, the bomb detonates at the entrance of the cave. So if the target is right next to where you drop the bomb, then yes, you could create large effect. But in this case, because the target is far away, the blast dissipates very fast, especially if you have to go through many twists and turns like in a cave or a tunnel.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. The bombs designed by An Duong have been criticized by people who say that instead of being called thermobaric, they should be called thermobarbaric. An Duong disagrees. She says the whole point of a better bomb is that it's meant to kill fewer people.
You know, any weapons of war are designed to kill. So once a weapon of war is created, the intention is to kill. The question then is how we use that weapon. When should it be used? In what manner? Do we use it responsibly or do we use it indiscriminately, like the communists did in Saigon, just to kill civilians? As a scientist and as somebody who has strong compassion to our troops, I want to make sure that if and when the United States, our country, our president, our Congress decide that we are going into war and we're going to send our guys into a war, then I want to make sure that I help them come back alive. And in order for them to come back alive, they have to have the best weapon. Otherwise, why would you go into a war? As far as this particular weapon, it was intended for tunnels and caves. I assume that you would agree and everybody would agree with me that civilians, you know, innocent people would have no business going into those caves unless they're prisoners or something. Mm-hmm. But why would a normal civilian hide out in mountainous caves and tunnels? You know, those have to be hideouts of terrorists or insurgents, people who are fighting against our guys. The weapon was designed specifically for tunnels, caves, structures. So it's even more discriminate than an air missile or a gun. The fact that we develop sophisticated weapons shouldn't be taboo. How we use the weapons, when we choose to go into war, that's a different question.
No, I understand that. It's just, I know that when people make a defense of the design of new weapons, they often will use the same argument that you are, that, you know, the use of the atomic bomb in Japan brought a quick end to the war and saved many lives. It's a valid claim, and the argument against it is valid as well. It's a gray area. I'm sure somebody would say that, you know, we made napalm to go in a flamethrower so we could kill people in caves, but you, well, a lot more than me, would know how it was misused in Vietnam. So it's always a gray area, isn't it?
I guess people say where you stand depends on where you sit. Coming from a background of mine, who was a refugee of war, who saw my country destroyed because South Vietnam did not have the means to win. It's not because South Vietnamese didn't want to stay free. It's not because we wanted to be communists. Mm-hmm. We wanted to be left alone. But we weren't allowed that. Why? Because we didn't have sophisticated weapons. We didn't have the means. We had to rely on generosity, on the help of other countries like the United States. As now a citizen of the United States, I wanted to make sure I don't ever want to be another refugee of war. So I vow that I would do anything and everything to make sure that this country, the second country of mine, stay as the home of the brave and the land of the free. I want to preserve this freedom, this paradise, for my family and for future generations of Americans.
An Duong is a weapons engineer and a science advisor to the Navy. If you'd like to read more about her and her work, you can check out our website at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Coming up, a creative journey into one of the world's most challenging terrains. This past winter, the New York City artist DJ Spooky turned his eyes and his ears to the big icy continent of Antarctica. He put together a considerable amount of money, hooked up with some other interested people, rented a research vessel, and set off for the South. It didn't take him long, as a well-wired New Yorker, to realize that he really was somewhere new.
When we had left Ushuaia,
That's at the southern end of Argentina.
The southern end of Argentina. I was still getting text messages and voicemail and email and everything, you know, Google text, Google map, until about 10 miles out into the ocean. And then all of a sudden my cell phone stopped working and there was no signal at all. And, you know, one could assume that's a signal drop, but it goes away for weeks.
The artistic work of DJ Spooky is all about connections. In his live shows, he stands on a stage, mixing sound and image, recombining and reimagining the elements of modern life. His normal creative process involves constant contact with the internet and a wide web of wireless friends, but as he was saying, in the Antarctic, he had to do things a little differently.
So I was stuck with what I just had with me, and I'd bought down a mini studio with me on the boat. So what was interesting was that I had prepared for that, and I kind of knew that that was the point, was to get away from all of the kind of urban density and see what kind of music comes out of that. But the sheer reality of being in the middle of an ocean, you know, the Drake Passage is one of the most dangerous passages in the world because it has these huge waves. You know, on old medieval maps or when America was first being explored, it said here be monsters kind of thing because the currents were crazy and the ship was heaving like just really big kind of waves back and forth. And I was trying to make some tracks.
You did some recording, though, while you were in the Drake Passage,
yeah.
right?
Was
that difficult at all? I mean, were you leaning over the rail of a ship, dangling a microphone at the bow?
Yeah, basically, yeah, yeah. The idea was it's acoustic portraits, so I wanted to really get sound from very specific environments. So, yeah, density on one hand of the city versus density of recording the environment around me, but leaning over the bow of the ship with the microphone, that's one thing. We were able to shoot all this high-definition footage of all these icebergs and stuff, which came out beautifully. When we were in the Drake Passage, one of the first things that came to mind was that there was this kind of perpetual dawn. The sun didn't set. So that kind of was a perfect photography kind of mode.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Once he made it through the Drake Passage, DJ Spooky was struck by the visuals, visuals that he saw clearly at all hours of the day from the deck of the ship.
Immense, I'm talking several city blocks long, maybe two or three stories high, chunks of ice just drifting in the water. The scale for these, for me being an urban dweller, an American, you know, who I've traveled a lot, but I've never seen something so stunningly gorgeous that wasn't human, you know, like there was no human hand that had shaped these ice pieces. They look like they've been run through some high-tech, you know, mega high-tech process. It's definitely one of those funny things where you just, they look sculptural. Yeah.
How did you figure out scale? Because, you know, when you're on the deck of the ship or when you're in one of the smaller boats or even if you're looking at aerial footage, I find one of the hardest things to do with images from Antarctica is say, well, okay, it's beautiful, but how big is it?
Right. Scale was that's the main problem, and it's something I'm going to be facing as we edit the film. Because for the most part, if you're living in a city, you're in what they call anthropocentric environment. Every door is made for you. The concrete is level. If you're walking on this stuff, you have to walk very carefully, for example, because the ice could collapse and you might find yourself in a crevice. Or The wind was so cold in one or two places that your breath would become these little ice crystals and fall to the ground. There was one point where I looked over and one of the people with me had some little tearing coming out of their goggles because the wind, when it's blowing on your eyes, you kind of, your eyes make this little protective layer. And yeah, the person had like frozen tear, you know, kind of. And I was like, yo, you got ice on your face, you know, it's pretty. And they didn't even notice because the ice was still warmer than the environment. But yeah, I mean, that's not downtown Manhattan at all. Let's put it that way.
DJ Spooky's Antarctica project is a work in progress at this point. I'll hear the story of his trip in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. The New York City musician and recording artist DJ Spooky is starting to unveil his latest project. He was here in The Story studios to give me a chance to listen in. He's working with sounds and images that he recorded on a trip to Antarctica this past winter. These are penguins he recorded and then mixed into something different. DJ Spooky says the deeper he got into Antarctica, the stranger it became. The light and the sounds, the landscape and the scale of it all are so unfamiliar that, well, that it's been his challenge to capture the full scope of what he saw there.
Once you're on the islands and you can kind of see off of the Antarctic Peninsula, there's lots of colonies of penguins. So that helped give scale. Like if you see a tiny little penguin and a huge piece of ice, you can kind of, the human eye can draw a relationship there. But once we got further into the ice shelf off of the Weddell Sea, that was where the sameness of the ice, the eye has to judge the kind of quality of the ice. I mean, there's stuff where the water's been running over it and it has these weird rivulets and grooves. There's other stuff that you can tell it's a glacial break. The time scale thing is also amazing because ice, it traps air. It's able to document the process of like millions of years. If you go dig down 100 feet, that's like a million years of time. All of that is stuff that I'm going to be exploring over the next couple of weeks as I edit how to look at this as a document or the ice as a record, you know, all puns intended, being DJing.
One of the things that you have to work with, given that it was summertime while you were down there, is that there's ice in the water and the water is moving and the ice in the water is moving. And I know from seeing breakup in northern Canada and places like that, that you can get everything from the crunch and the crash to this amazing sort of unique tinkling sound of what they call candle ice, just the mm-hmm. little strips of crystal before they turn into water. What was it like for you as an audio engineer walking around and listening to this palette of sound?
Well, the funny thing is that it took my ears probably a good couple days to adjust to the silence. Again, it's that withdrawal thing. I mean, forget the web and everything else, but New York itself is a sound system. I mean, it might as well. You have sirens going off, fire trucks going by.
Almost to the point where you don't hear them if you're there.
Right. You just have to learn psychologically to screen it out. Then being there, it was almost like you've been in a pressure cooker in New York for years. I mean, I live there. I have to deal with the sound. New York's probably one of the loudest cities in the world. I think people have measured New York sound versus Tokyo versus Paris or London. New York, by far, is one of the loudest cities. There's always a heavy... Somebody was comparing it to the sound of artillery. Or, you know, I mean, just that level of noise, you know? So the way people become accustomed to noise is to filter it out psychologically. You're still getting the same volume, but you don't pay attention to it. It just becomes a wall. So in Antarctica, hearing your feet crunch, next step, next foot, you know, I was like, wait a second, I'm the only one making real noise here except for the wind or the occasional cry of a bird or a penguin or something. You're even hearing your own breath, you know, because there's nothing else to really compare it to. It's kind of, you're your own sound generating machine here. I've felt, it was the first time in my adult life, again, being from an urban context where you realize sound is how you navigate, it's how you establish your spatial sense of orientation. And there'd be times where you'd walk out into an ice field, and because of the optical quality of the ice and stuff, even if you know where you've come from and you can see your footprints going back over the land, it gets very easy to get lost.
Was there ever a time when you intentionally put yourself in a place either on the other side of a hill or around some peninsula where you knew you'd be and you wouldn't see the Russian ship and you wouldn't see the Zodiacs and you wouldn't see the other people who were traveling with you? So really, you know, no matter which way you turned your head, there was nothing? Or at least no sign of life, you know, animal life or human life?
Oh, that was the point, yeah. I mean, every time we landed, I would pretty much say, I'll see you guys in about 8 hours, you know. And then we'd just go as far away from everybody as possible. So, yeah, I definitely wanted to plan and shape the trip on this idea of getting away. I mean, the best part about it was just going and sitting on like an ice rock, you know, without anybody around and just hearing the sound of the, I mean, it was freezing, but it was worth it.
Are you concentrating on the electronic equipment you've got with you? Am I getting a good recording of this? Where's my digital camera? How are my batteries holding up? Or is there a time when you would, you know, take the headphones off and just try to be as quiet as possible, just sort of let it wash over you?
Yeah, a little bit of both. I mean, we spent Christmas near the Drake Passage and New Year's Eve off these ice fields near the curve of the Antarctic Peninsula where there's this sort of huge waves coming in, but also ice fields and stuff. You know, so the richness of experience, you know, sometimes you don't want to record that kind of thing. You just want to be in the moment. And the only image you'll walk away from is your own memory, you know. We live in a time where everybody's documenting a lot of stuff and putting it on, you know, video blogs, Facebook blog, you know, whatever.
Just you are a leader of this craft. I mean, you're not just watching it along with the rest of us. And I guess if that's why I'm pressing you on this, it's because your art is a way of expressing so many different facets of the human condition at any one given time that when you remove all those aspects, the availability of the images and the kind of digital access to the rest of the world that's happening, what's the effect on you, on your emotions? Did you feel isolated? Did you feel lonely? Did you say, okay, well, you know, 20 minutes of this is plenty. I'm going to go look for someone to talk to.
No. I mean, if anything, I travel alone a lot. I used to travel like four or five assistants when you're doing DJ shows. Next thing you know, the show ends at 2 a.m. and you still have to get up to go to the next show or something. And your assistants have been partying harder than you have and you have to take care of them. Little things like that where I realize, okay, I can travel just basically with a briefcase, with my laptop and a hard drive, and that's the show. I preferred to do this alone in a way that let me kind of look at it as a personal journey. And in fact, I enjoyed the richness of being away from all the hecticness of New York and the zillions of people I have to deal with and all the different shows. And it was kind of hitting the reset button on my own imagination. And sometimes it's good to just withdraw from all that.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. The New York recording artist, DJ Spooky, chartered his own research vessel for a recording trip to Antarctica. And while he was there, he also had his eyes open for examples of climate change. He says it came through to him in more human terms, troubles that other vessels were having navigating familiar routes.
A month before we had gone down, a ship had sunk called the Explorer. It hit an iceberg that was uncharted, and while we were down there, another passenger ship got a distress thing because its engines failed. And it's by law of the sea, you have to go rescue them. So this is a couple days before we're going to head back. We get a distress signal about 2 a.m. Don't forget it's still daytime, sort of.
Right.
And all of a sudden, we all feel the ship turn around and go charging at full speed away from our agreed destination. And so I went up to the captain's bridge to ask what was up. And they said, well, we've received a distress call from a Norwegian passenger ship, and we have to go help them. So all the ships in the area were talking over these high, kind of weird satellite phones and coordinating the rescue effort. As it turned out, we were told a couple hours later, oh, actually, we're not in distress anymore. We're okay. False alarm. What ended up happening is we pulled up next morning in the island where we were going to go, and the Norwegian ship limped into harbor. It had smashed into a glacier iceberg kind of that had just come off the shelf, and their engines had just stopped, and they didn't know why, but they realized it was a software glitch.
So all this ice in the water, are the scientists saying that there's a presence of ice in the water that's somehow related to climate change, or is that just a normal state of affairs down there?
don't forget, the continent contracts and expands every season, but there are some record level, like this year they had a record level of certain larger chunks breaking off. While I was down there, a 30-mile chunk broke off. Supposedly.
Wait a second, a 30-mile wide chunk of one of the ice shelves?
Yeah, which is huge. I mean, it became a navigation hazard, for example.
It's like a small country.
Yeah, yeah. There's icebergs bigger than Connecticut, you know.
Did you go to where it was? Or
We had to skirt around it because it was drifting. And whenever one iceberg breaks, there's usually several chunks of it floating, and those aren't mapped or charted.
Right.
When you have $100 million ship, you know, which had a reinforced hull the month before sink, I mean, it was major international news. So people were being very cautious. But what that meant was they just hadn't mapped out the new ice breaks, and all this larger chunks than expected were coming out.
What interests me about these things, Paul, is that they are so complicated. There's nothing's really simple down there. I don't know if you came away from your time there with that same kind of or with a different appreciation of what's going on down there.
Well, the whole idea was to kind of look at it as poetry or some kind of lyrical engagement. The science is there, and I think people have the facts presented to them that this is definitely a radical break of some kind of pattern. While all of that is, I think, at least very available and obvious, the part about experiencing a continent that's rapidly changing is it's bigger than human scale, so we're not really sure how to experience or interpret that. So that gives the climate change deniers still some room for movement. You know, I don't know why they want to deny, but it's definitely...
They'll always be there.
Yeah. As an artist, I mean, I'm definitely intrigued by the scientific representation of change, but also it's experiential. I really wanted to get down there to have a portrait of it.
What for you, Paul, would be the one image that comes most quickly to your mind when you think back on the time that you spent down there, or the moment that where you thought to yourself, "Boy, I really am not in Kansas or 34th Street anymore." What would be the clearest moment that you can think of?
The clearest moment was definitely on Deception Island when we got there and I walked away from the whole group and just looked out at these huge expanses of ice that were in some of the back areas. And I was wondering, what would happen if there are no people here at all, you know, and our species had outlived its interaction with the planet and somehow there's no people, you know, and that eerie sense of, it's hard to imagine the planet without people, you know, we're...
But you could imagine that on that day in that place, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
What was it like?
It's cold. And you realize that's, even if you look at the Inuit or the Eskimo up in the north, they had some relationship to forest lands where they could make sleds and they could get tools out of that. There's none of that there. There's no trees. You'd have to have everything be made from stones, maybe. There's no metal. The Russians, of course, are looking for oil, come to think of it. Sitting on this rock, I'm realizing, you know, what would happen if we were cut off from all that stuff? I think human beings, we've displaced the natural with our artificial sense of urbanism, but somehow we'll have to build bridges between a vision of nature that is sustainable, but also one where human beings have voluntarily said, we're not going to change this.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. And so the trip ended, and the vessel headed back to shore, and DJ Spooky, he also goes by the name Paul Miller, he tracked that shift back to reality in the same way that he had when he left for the Antarctic.
When we finally got back a couple, you know, about 5 hours outside of the landscape, my cell phone started beeping with messages and text messages and email, meaning we'd gotten, because I was half asleep, or not half, like totally asleep in my... Even then, I had gotten into the habit of usually putting my cell phone in a charger and making sure it would be ready. Because as soon as I got back, I had one day in Ushuaia to go through and compile my footage. Then I had to fly back to New York, get everything ready for Sundance, and then go straight to Sundance.
So you had a few messages waiting for you.
I had lots.
How many?
Oh, God, hundreds. For email, a couple, probably about 2,000. Because I didn't, you know, most of my friends are... I set up a vacation message saying, Paul is in Antarctica. I'm not answering email.
Didn't matter.
Had thousands of email, lots of text messages.
So you're asleep and you hear it beeping, and what's your first reaction?
I was like, oh, brother, the invisible networks have come back, and as soon I'm going to have to hit the ground running.
Having adapted to life without all those digital networks, how smooth was the shifting of gears back into a sort of high-speed life that is normal for you?
It was utterly seamless. It felt like it had never been gone. Even though, I mean, you can be in the most remote part. I hadn't necessarily been out of my system of thought.
You hadn't lost that language, that no. digital language. It's just...
But that would take years to do. I think it would probably take years to deprogram from feeling all this digital media stuff around. I probably think the next generation of people coming up is going to assume it's part of the landscape, much like, you know, you turn on the faucet and you expect water, you know?
I still find, though, that when I go somewhere far enough away that there's no electricity and no sort of network, that I feel a little sluggish when I get back in. It's like, oof, I got to get, you know, back up to the speed. I need to be, you know, thinking with different parts of my brain all at the same time once again.
Right. I didn't feel that at all. I mean, once we were off the coast and my normal, I get text messages and email from my friends and various social networks online constantly. So it was just like hitting the ground running. I said, hey, everybody, I'm back in town, or not in town. I'm in Ushuaia, the southernmost city. But it didn't feel like it was something that was a shock of, you know, this is new. And it just felt like a return to like putting on a pair of warm, comfortable socks or something, you know.
I'm back.
Yeah.
DJ Spooky is also known as Paul Miller. He's based in New York City. He did a sneak preview of his Antarctica show last month in Milan. There'll be another version of it later this summer in Denver at the Democratic National Convention. We have links for you to see more and hear more of DJ Spooky's work, and you can find that all on our site at thestory.org. Last week, I talked with Mohammed Fikri from L.A. I said at the time that he was, at one time, the very definition of the frequent flyer, logging close to 5 million miles on American Airlines. Mohammed was telling me about the troubles he's had flying as an Egyptian-American since 9/11, like the time he woke up and heard the captain on the intercom.
We have a national security matter. And I figured, oh, man, that's great. At least we landed safe. When they opened the door, they all swarming toward my seat. And the finger was pointed at me. They said, get your belongings off the plane. We're taking your bag off the plane. And everybody asked me, well, what did you say? Well, what the heck are you going to say when you got 15 guys with guns and badges? You're going to tell them, no, I'm not. Of course I did.
Mohammed eventually had his name cleared. Turns out it was a case of mistaken identity. It just so happened that the airlines were on extra high alert that day. And Mohammed, as he said, well, his name is Mohammed. Sarah from Los Angeles wrote to say that she also had a bad experience with American Airlines trying to get back to L.A. from London a week after the second bombing there in 2005. Sarah wrote, I'd taken a multi-leg journey to get to London, L.A., Milwaukee, Sevilla, Madrid, London, L.A., and somehow the student travel agent I had used forgotten to buy the last leg of the trip for me. Well, after much hullabaloo, I was forced to buy a one-way ticket to L.A. from London. Not a good idea when you have an Islamic last name, even if you are a small 5'2", 100-pound female. Once I picked up the connecting flight on American Airlines in the U.S., Sarah wrote, I was immediately made aware that the flight attendants there considered themselves to be part of the front line in the war against terror. All three managed to yell at me at some point, with one even announcing over the intercom, when I had gone to the restroom, that I needed to return to my seat because I was a security threat. I realized on the plane that were I to protest my situation, I would confirm the perceptions of others that I was combative and perhaps dangerous. It's quite disempowering to realize that the best thing you can do is seethe with your mouth shut. I also got a note from Rick in Chicago. Rick writes, although born here in Chicago, I'm of Mexican and Italian descent, so some people think I'm ethnic or foreign-looking. I travel about 10 to 12 times a year, so I always make a point of being clean-shaven. From the time I check in at the airport until I step aboard the plane and take my seat, I make a point of smiling and saying good morning or hello to all the airline or security I deal with. I want them to hear my cheery Midwestern accent. The few times when I was too rushed to have shaved or rolled out on the wrong side of bed have been those times when I've been pulled from the line and won the added scrutiny of TSA personnel. If you have any thoughts or suggestions of stories or travel adventures that you'd like to pass along to me, you can write to me at The Story. Go to our website. It's the quickest way to get to me, thestory.org. Or you can call and leave a message on our telephone line, 1-888-966. 9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.